Good morning. So we are continuing in, as for the per the lectionary, the Sermon on the Mount. And that, as I probably said last week, contains some of the most famous teachings of Jesus, and certainly some of the most quoted, but also some of the most difficult. And as Jesus talks through, really unveiling kind of his vision for how the renewed people of Israel should live and go about their lives, Jesus gives an interpretation of the law and the prophets, the requirements from the Hebrew Bible, and he makes them more difficult. And that creates a temptation. And I believe it was Dr. Laurel Robinson, no relation, New Testament scholar, to point out that sometimes when Christians read the Sermon on the Mount, we think, okay, this is all really well and good, it's a good idea, so how do we get out of it? Because, yikes. For example, he'll go on to say, like, it's all well and good to not murder people, and again, I would commend you, please don't murder people. But if you harbor anger in your heart, it's the same thing. I get the impulse to get out of that. And so I think one of the things that we're going to do as we go through this particular reading is talk a little bit about this idea of the law. Because there's more going on here than we might think. But he begins this particular section with telling the people around him, you are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world. And salt, we as modern people tend to think of as sodium chloride with or without iodine. You can charge more without the iodine and call it artisanal salt or something like that. It's basically the same stuff. But you do need iodine, so there's your health tip for the day. And so when Jesus says, if it loses its saltiness, that, well, sodium chloride without its saltiness is a water, I guess? I don't really know what that is. But salt for them wasn't just that. It was a pretty complex combination of minerals. Sodium chloride would have been one of them. Potassium chloride in some various forms. Some kind of magnesium and some other sorts of salts. No, as far as I know, no sodium citrate, which is a bummer because that's how you make really good cheese sauce. Just file that away for later. Google it. It's amazing. Anyway, and so it can be used as a preservative. It can be used for flavoring. It can also be used for fertilizer. And depending on how well it is stored, it can actually lose some of those minerals. They can leach out, and then they become useless for what you intend to do with them. So the metaphor actually works. Now, what we do with that is a different thing entirely. Now, he seems to link this with the idea of being a light. You know, you light a lamp, as Herman put it, and he gave the kids candles. Thankfully, thank you for not giving them lighters, too. I so appreciate your good judgment. I don't want those emails. Anyway, you don't light a light so that you can look at the light. This was actually the point of Christmas. You light the light so that you can see, and it reveals everything around you. It gives you a better sense of reality. And so between those two, Jesus is speaking at the beginning of his ministry to a group of people. It's fair to say they are mostly, if not entirely, Jewish. And Jesus, first and foremost, as he begins his ministry, is to get, like John the Baptist, to get people ready and thinking and acting in line with their identity as Israel. In other words, if you can sum all of that up, it's, you are God's chosen people, so act like it. That's where things start. And, as it turns out, if you do act like that, then take the salt analogy, you can become a place, not just a person, but a group of people, and therefore a place, an institution, whose goal is to contribute to the thriving of human life. Now, there's a lot of different ways that we can interpret that. We'll probably save that for a different day. But first and foremost, the place of Jesus' followers and the intention for God's people is to be a place that values life and puts immeasurable amounts of value on human life in all of its forms, regardless of where they are or who they are, and to contribute to their thriving. So first and foremost, that's a tall order. And then secondly, you are the light of the world. So it's not that people look at you, but rather when they get a sense, or when they see how you are and how you live, this is Jesus talking to his people, then people will maybe start to see a different reality about themselves. This is maybe like setting, as my mom would say when I was like the oldest in a group of friends, set a good example. Fine. Which always inevitably meant I didn't, but whatever. And it's essentially all getting siphoned back into the law and the prophets. Because first off, God speaks through his prophets, one, by the words of Torah, by the words of my teaching or my law, you will live. Which is why there's a long Jewish tradition of valuing life above all other things. And according to the prophets, you, as the people of Israel, will be a light to all the nations, a light to the Gentiles. You will show them what it means to live as a truly human being in the best sense of the word. In other words, Jesus, in his own cryptic way, is pulling from the great traditions of the law and the prophets and telling the people again who they are. You are for the thriving of your fellow brothers and sisters. You are a light and an example of what it means to be truly human in the best sense of the word to the rest of the world. Tall order. Really tall order. And then Jesus shifts and he says, don't think for a second that I've come to just throw the law away. Which, I don't know about you, but if somebody says, hey, like, if you're asking, hey, don't think I didn't steal that, or something like that, you're going to go, who's accusing you of stealing things? In other words, for Jesus to say that almost certainly means somebody is accusing him of wanting to throw out the law and the prophets and get rid of all of their Jewish traditions or something like that. And Jesus did get accused of that in various ways. And instead, what he says is, no, I've come to fulfill it. And the classic way that especially like Lutherans and other groups have interpreted that is, therefore Jesus does everything and we don't have to do anything. Ooh, whew. For a second there, I thought I was going to have to change. And I think we can immediately feel right there that's probably not what Jesus has in mind. But there is something to that, but we have to sit on it. Because then Jesus goes on and talks about how important God's commandments, God's laws, his teaching, all of those words can be used to translate the word Torah. And he goes on to say, not an iota or a dot. I think that English can't really translate what Jesus is saying right there. It has to do with like little tiny pen strokes, depending on the script you're using, and blah blah blah. Basically, the details matter, which immediately makes me go, ugh. But whatever. But if you notice, and you can look in your bulletin if you need to, Jesus will say, until all of this is complete or fulfilled. And then he seems to double down. and say, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, who were the religious elite. It took at least a month of application and examination of the life and the way you live to become a Pharisee. These guys were not playing around. And there's kind of a wide variation of thought in terms of Pharisees. Some of them tended to be like the really not fun people who you don't invite to parties, and others tended to be more lenient, and they did not get along, as you might imagine. Think like Republicans, Democrats, that sort of thing. We're all Americans, and then, which is unfortunate. But nevertheless, when Jesus says, you've got to be better than they are, that's almost an impossible order for the average person. So how do we pull all of this together? Well, this is where like the classic Lutheran distinction of the meaning of the law can be really helpful. And there are three. That's slightly controversial, but whatever. We're not going to go there. One of the uses of the law is to do it. I was hoping that was way funnier than it was. I was like, come on, think about that. There is a very, very significant sense that when Jesus says, turn the other cheek, love your neighbor as yourself, pray for your enemy, or love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you, so on and so forth, he simply just means do it. Not complicated. At least it's not complicated until you start looking at your own life. And I don't know about you, but it's pretty easy to come up with ways that not only have I broken, say, like the Ten Commandments, but as Jesus makes things more difficult and he centers our actions on really where they all begin, which is the human heart, that I may be in trouble. And so in that sense, the laws that Jesus is a big fan of, can act like a mirror and it just shows you who you really are. And that's deeply uncomfortable. That kind of self-examination and exposure hurts. I mean, think of the analogy of just the mirror. The older I get, the worse that is. And the more like things you need to get to like ear hair, it's a mess. You know what I mean, most of you. And it's meant, in a sense, to break us. Because it shows us our need. We'll come back to that in a minute. Another use of the law is to act as a guide rail or a curb. Or a track, or something like that. There are lots of different analogies. In other words, they kind of help guide what you should do, where you should go, how to do it. Like in your interactions with others, knowing that the commandment is, love your neighbor as though they were you, and love your enemy, and pray for those who wish to harm you. In that way of thinking about the law, these are guidelines. These are ways to think about how to interact with those around you. And this even can get uncomfortable because it's really easy to start thinking about all of the ways that I don't measure up to that. And unless I've totally misjudged this group, my suspicion is that I'm not the only one thinking that. However, if this was something that we sat on and meditated on over and over, not because it proves anything or we make ourselves good and so we can pat ourselves on the back, because that's a different thing entirely, but rather just out of a good-hearted desire to do the right thing, I think the world would be a significantly better place. And in fact, I would commend that to all of us. And then finally, there's a sense in which, like, meditating on God's desire and intention for human life can change us. When we receive faith, when we are baptized into Jesus' death, raised in his resurrection, that's not the end of our story. And in fact, that's the part of the reason why a shell is such an important part of baptism imagery. That just marks the beginning. That marks just the start as we begin walking and wandering as followers and disciples of Jesus. And over time, the hope and the work of the Holy Spirit will come and pull you and create out of you something that looks a little bit more like Jesus. The fancy word for this is sanctification, being made more holy. There's a danger there, however. There are so-called holiness movements within the large kind of diverse, crazy tent we call the Christian tradition, and there are groups that just triple down on this idea of being holy. And having spent some time with those groups in my wild and weird days of my youth, it's exhausting. And a lot of things get swept under the rug because it creates an atmosphere and attitude that I can't be really honest about who I really am and what I'm struggling with. But being able to be honest is a real gift. So, if Jesus doubles and then triples down on how difficult the law really is, and it's not a matter of your own actions, we can all take a whole bunch of regulations about how we act, but we know that ultimately it is not addressing where the core of the problem is, which is our hearts. Just in the same way that there are speed limits posted everywhere, which here in Albuquerque, I realize, is more of just a suggestion, except for the few roads where there are cameras that have not yet been stolen. You know where they are, and you know what to do. we need to move on before I say something real bad. You can legislate the speed you drive all the time. But what would it take for you to want to drive as safely as possible? That's the difference. That's the way that Jesus makes things even more difficult. But notice that he says, until all things have been fulfilled, or kind of when all everything comes together. Again, it's a little weird in Greek, and so the English feels sometimes a little bit awkward. That nothing I said about those other uses of the law are canceled out. Jesus calls his disciples, and then therefore us, to really do and be like that, to follow Jesus. Allow the Spirit to work in our hearts and change them. But we can't get away from the mirror. The mirror that shows us who we really are. That upon real, serious reflection, we stand in front of it and recognize that we're not as okay as we thought we are. Or as someone, I can't remember their name. Someone pointed out, Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself. So I started hating all my neighbors. That's funny until you realize what it implies. An old friend and colleague of mine named Hal would often say, love your neighbor as yourself, and this is still Hal speaking, and I've found that to be true. We really do. We will tend to love our neighbors however we love ourselves. And it is in that exposure, under that light, so to speak, examining the mineral contents of what we bring to the table as salt and light, that Jesus uses fulfillment style language. That the Sermon on the Mount and basically everything that follows this, that all still stands, but see it in the context of just the beginning. Because Jesus really intends for us to do those things. And again, the world would be amazing if we did. But there's that problem of our hearts. We can get a bunch of rules to follow, and it's not going to change much. However, if we begin to more fully understand, and by the power of the Spirit internalize and meditate on what Jesus has actually done for us, we'll realize that something deep within us is dying, and something deep within us is being raised from the dead. That when Jesus brings that sense of death, that conviction, that realization as we stare at ourselves and the wreckage of our own actions, either to ourselves or those around us, and in recognizing that great and deep need, Jesus, by fulfilling everything that the laws and the prophets pointed to, brings us down into his own grave. And wherever Jesus brings death, he brings new life. And he raises us from the dead. And this is why, and I'll end with this, the Sermon on the Mount is so complicated. Because it's so hard to follow. It's so easy to try and come up with, but wait, but what if, and okay, you say love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, but what if they're really bad? That's not how that works. And there's this deep uncomfortableness. Or if we say, all right, we are going to do this. We are going to absolutely live by every single standard and rule and jot and tittle and everything else. We're either going to have to convince ourselves that we did it, even though we didn't, and become therefore insufferable. Or we fall into absolute despair because we know we can't. And I think that's not the point. The point is to do them and be transformed by them, but recognizing that it all comes from the new person that Jesus has and is making you into. That just like a doctor prescribing medication tells you, over time, you will get better. You will feel more life. You'll have more energy. You'll be able to breathe clearer, whatever. That over time, by the power of God's Spirit, we are being transformed into something different. Something that looks a lot more like Jesus. Where loving our neighbor becomes maybe a little bit more second nature. Praying for those we perceive of as our enemies becomes the knee-jerk reaction instead of attacking. And so on and so forth. And as the lectionary continues, we'll explore some more of this. But the good news is not that we get to get out of the Sermon on the Mount, but rather that Jesus enters into this moment with us and brings healing and hope and new life to our own hearts. Amen.